Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 16, delivered on October 22, 2015. The title of this lecture is Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return.
Today, Net Present Value and Internal Rate of Return. This is otherwise known as capital budgeting or capital budgeting decision making. How we figure out whether or not to say yes to a project that is put before us, a capital project, in other words, a long-term project. We're going to kick money in, and then we are hoping that we will get money back out of the projects that we take on. But there are a lot of projects that might come before us, and we have to say yes to some, no to others. Now, in some cases, it would be a matter, well, we just can't afford all the projects. But honestly, if the project is a good project, we probably could figure out some way. There are just a couple of cases where we can't. But in a lot, most of the time, it comes down to whether or not the project is going to have a positive net return to us. And there are some very traditional ways that this is done. I would caution that there are really old ways that were done in the old days, and I'm going to bring those up here just to say don't. And then there are some new ways that I'm not going to show you here that are kind of trickling in around the edges in the real high-powered, high-tech companies. I might mention those later in the course. But what I'm showing you here is best practices right now. How do we decide whether or not to do a project? And that starts with essentially how much is it going to cost us? That cash outflow that starts the whole ball rolling. That's our negative cash flow at time zero. Then we have to go through this process of projecting what the revenue stream, or the, let's put it this way, more the net income stream is going to be from the project over its life. And usually we say, okay, what's the best way to project it? We do best practices on that, and then someone can yell at us later, well, we didn't meet our projections. Well, we did our best on that, and we'll talk a little about forecasting later. But right now we put those off to the side and say, all right, we're going to have a project. It's going to put some money in, really. It's going to put some money in right off the bat. Try this marker. Here at time zero. And then over the life of the project, there's going to be a negative amount here. And then over the life of the project, there's going to be money that comes in from the project. And at the end of the project, there might be some salvage value. And I'll mention that here in just a second. But we'll assume, as most companies do, that all the cash flow occurs at the ends of the periods through the life of the project. So we might want to say, all right, let's put in, we're going to look at a project that has a $10,000 cash outflow at the beginning, negative $10,000. And then the project begins to pull in money. In the first year, let's say it pulls in $2,000. The second year, it's going to, let's say it begins to pick up a little bit of speed, and it's going to pull in $2,500. Then it's going to pull in year three, $3,000. Year four, $3,000. Year five, it's beginning to tail off back down, say $2,000. And in the last year, the project delivers to us 45, 75. let's say that it pulls in $1,000 and we can get rid of the equipment at the end. Salvage value of the equipment is $200. That let's say that the project, let me do this. Let's say the project is a $12,000 project. Keep the numbers a little bit smoother here. Now, the salvage value might not always be there, but, and I don't know that the book shows too many with salvage value, but know this, if there is a salvage value at the end, you just add it to the last year's cash flow. In the real world, companies should get rid of old equipment. When a project is gone, throw it out. In practical terms, though, you'll see a lot of companies don't do that. And a great example, downstairs here, there is this room that no one is allowed to, normal people aren't allowed to get into. I'm not allowed in there. I can't remember how I got, oh, that's right, I broke into that room. Anyway, I went in there, and there were all these computers. And I'm not talking about old computers. I'm not talking about computers from the from the early 2000s, not computers from 1990s. I'm talking about things that were from the 1980s. They were just stacked around down there. Monitors, these little monitors, and these old computers. And why didn't you get rid of those? And you'll see this sometimes in companies. They'll have this equipment that was used years ago, and they never dumped it. It's almost like a hoarding complex. Oh, well, it might be valuable again someday. No, that computer is not even going to be valuable. It's not even a relic. It is fossilized. But so keep an eye on that. In some companies, they do dump equipment, sell it off to these buyers for pennies on the dollar. And other companies, they don't want to let go of it. Well, one way or the other. If you see a salvage value, just add it onto last year's cash flow. And always, when you're doing projections, try to impose salvage value. Like, we're working this out so that we're going to get rid of this equipment, so it's part of the capital plan of the project, that when it's over, you don't even think about it. It's in the plan. We sell this right away. Anyway, getting off that. How we decide on the project. We want to find the present value of these future expected cash flows, and then we compare that to the cost right now of the project. If the result is a positive number, in other words, the present value of the future expected cash flows minus the initial cash flow, if that's a positive number, we say yes. If it's a negative number, we say no. End of the story. It's just up or down. Negative, no. Positive, yes. That is, it's a very clean decision-making process. And don't let anyone muddy it up. The first thing that you're going to have to do to get present values, of course, is to get a cash discount rate. For now, I'll just pull one out of the air. Let's say discount the cash flows at, for our purposes, let's do 9.5%. Discount the cash flows at 9.5%. Now, later, as I've told you before, I'll show you how we actually get that 9.5%. It's really simple. It's called the capital asset pricing model. It's standard best practices, and if you use that, you've got defense of someone asking about, well, how did you get that discount rate? So in other words, we're going to discount these back to the present, and then we're going to take the sum of those present values, and we're going to add it to the negative cash flow here at the beginning. Positive, yes. Negative, no. And that's all there is to it. Now, back in the day, this was a pain in the butt to do, especially if you had a long-term project, pulling all those cash flows back and all that kind of stuff, taking each one present value of a lump sum of so much for 1 year, present plus present value of a lump sum of something else for another year, all that. Let me show you, though. With the modern calculators we have, this is done very easily. Now, I'm going to use the, let me have a little light in here. You guys creep me out when you're in the dark. Your eyes kind of glow. It's really weird. But anyway, I'm going to show you. I'll do this on the Pearson calculator. The TI-83 is actually very simple to do this on too. Although I have to say, I've used the TI-83 plus and 84 for years. And this thing is actually even a little faster than that one. Show you how you do it. It's just a mechanical thing. Watch this. Okay, the first thing that you'll probably want to do to pull this off is hit reset on your calculator just to clear the memory buffers. It's good best practices. Clear the memory buffers. Now we're going to do cash flow, CF. Now CF0 is that initial outlay of money. What did I say, $12,000 negative? $12,000 plus or minus. Okay, now hit enter. Now go down, and cash flow one. What did I put for the cash flow one? I can't even see it. 2,000. 2,000. Enter. Now go down. You're going to see F1. That's how many times $1,000 happens year over year or period over period. In this case, it's one, so we're fine with that. You don't even have to hit enter. If it's one, don't even bother. If it's more than one, you should hit enter. Now, cash flow two was 2,500. Oh, someone, for God's sake, answer me. Yeah, thank you. 2,500. Okay, 2,500. And then you hit enter, and then you drop down. Frequency is one, so you don't have to hit enter. That's the default frequency for the out cash flows. And then we've got a cash flow. I'm not even going to bother to try to ask. $3,000. Okay, $3,000 is the next cash flow. And in this case, that'll happen twice. Okay, enter down. And this time I'm going to hit two. Now you could do 3,000 for one and then 3,000 again, but it's a lot easier, especially if there are multiple years of the same cash flow consecutively. And I hit two, enter. Now I go down to the fourth cash flow. It's 2,000, thank you. 2,000. And that's a one-year cash flow. So I just hit enter, drop it down. And then the next one is drop it down again. And the what's that last one there? Five is 1,000. Wait. I've screwed something up. Oh, that's right. Okay. I wish it wouldn't do that. Okay, I got a little confused there. So now I'm going to put in the last year's, which is 1,200. Again, add the salvage value to that last one. Don't forget to do that. Okay, enter, and that is going to occur once. Enter. Now, the last thing you're going to do is put in your discount rate. 9.5 I over Y. I'd hit 19.5. 9.5 I over Y. Now, we finish this up by saying compute the NPV, net present value. Whoa! -$1,750.21. We say no. Project is a reject. Reject the project. It's a negative number, so you just say, nah, that's it. Here's the thing. When you do these kinds of problems, if you hit this in the real world, which some of you will, or at least your project will be shot down because of this. That's the fun thing, is marketing people to come to us with great projects, and we get to say no to them. They look so sad. But negative is pretty common. It's ordinary. Big negative can be not that unusual. Positives, if you're going to have a positive, it's probably going to be not too positive. But if it's positive at all, you say yes to it. If it's massively positive, you start to think, wait, why would this project be this good and no one has seen this before? None of our competitors are doing this. There's a little bit of suspicion when you see a big positive net present value on a project. Why hasn't anyone caught this before us? Are we that special in the universe? So it's typical for projects to be negative or big negative. It's not unusual to get a positive net present value project, but you should be suspicious if it is too positive on the net present value side. Now, there's a thing going on here about this, important to bring up. The discount rate that I used is critical to the net present value, because the bigger the discount rate that you use, the stronger the impact will be in killing off these cash flows out here. You see what I mean? As that discount rate gets bigger, these as present values get smaller. In this case, if I were to plot net present value against the discount rate that I used, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Let me take this clear up. 10, 11, 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. And I have discount rates 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%, 11%. Okay, and that's a 1% there. That's positive $100 increments on the vertical axis and negative $100 going down. Okay. Now, in this case, when I used a discount rate of 9.5%, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9.5%, this net present value was very negative, nasty negative. Watch what happens if I had said, oh, my bad, I meant to use a discount rate of 5%. Compute the net present value. Ooh, at 5%, it's only negative $305. About there. Okay, what happens if I use 2%? For my discount rate, 2%. Notice, by the way, this is really nice about this, that you can try different discount rates, compute the net present value. Oh, well, spank me Jesus. It's positive NPV at 2%, $839. $839. So at 2%, it's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, a little more, yeah. A little more than $800. Well, look at that. The NPV is actually a function. It's a graph. Kind of a linear. I so suck at drawing lines. No, I'm not drunk. I've got arthritis. Okay, look. The lower the discount rate, the higher the net present value. There's a point where you would get, you choose a discount rate that you could actually get this project to be a go. I want you to notice something here. This crossing point right here, see this crossing point right here? This is a special place. This is where the discount rate, where the net present value switches from positive to negative. That point is called the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return, IRR. Now, you write this down because this is a classic gimme question for an essay on an exam. Hint, hint. Nudge, nudge. Wink, wink. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. Now, you be sure that you say it that way. If you leave out a word, then you're wrong. A few of those words are actually kind of important. It is the discount rate that makes net present value zero. So here we go. Can we find the internal rate of return? Let me tell you, back in the day, before calculators, this was a real pain in the derry rear to find that, because you'd have to guess a discount rate, find the net present value. Okay, that's positive. Try another discount rate way out here. Okay, that's negative. And then work your way back and forth, manually calculating net present values until you got close enough to the to NPV equals zero to be able to say this is the IRR. That was way too much like work. But now we have these calculators. Watch this. Compute the internal rate of return. Let me tell you, from my perspective, having spent like an hour chasing down a stupid internal rate of return, pushing a button is amazing. It's 4.16. I was sort of close. If you graph this really well, you can actually eyeball, which is what I would do, is I would graph one on the downside, one on the upside, and then very carefully graph it. That way I had a really good idea of where that point was, and so I didn't have to iterate back and forth too much. But now, I mean, there it is. In this case, it's 4.16%. So in other words, if I choose any discount rate that is below 4.16%, I accept the project. If I choose any discount rate above 4.16%, I reject the project. That's all there is to it. It's that simple. And that's why it's sometimes very useful just to grab your internal rate of return right off the bat. Then, if someone gives you a discount rate, you know right away whether it's a go or a no-go. I come to you, madam, and I give you the cash flows. I'm your supervisor in the Treasury Department, and I give you these cash flows, negative cash outflow, and then the positive cash inflow. So I said, and you say, wait a minute, what's my discount rate? Well, the chief financial officer will come to your desk tomorrow and tell you the discount rate, okay? While you're working furiously you just do the internal rate of return, you find out that the internal rate of return for the project is 6.72%. Well, the next day comes, and there's this nice music playing, Muzak, Macklemore, or something like that, and then all of a sudden, the speakers stop playing the music, and all of a sudden they start playing ba 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 ba. And you know exactly what that means. The chief financial officer is coming in. And he comes right up to your desk. The discount rate you should use for this project is 7.2%. Now give me the answer within 1 hour. And I whirl around. My robes flow out. And you say, excuse me, sir.
Did you call me sir?
Yes, sir. I did. What are you going to say? Don't say I cannot. Be forceful. I am a Sith. I need an answer, okay? For God's sake. You know what happens to people who equivocate with a Sith? They start having breathing problems real fast. Say it.
We're not
No. You say, reject the project. That's all you say. Reject the project. Because what was the discount? What was the internal rate of return I gave you?
6.72.
And what did? What was the? That was the internal rate. And what was the internal rate of return?
7.5.
Wait, I think you got him back. My God, die! What was the internal rate of return? Don't answer. You're dead. What was the internal rate of return that she found? What was it? 6.72%, I think I said. And what discount rate did I tell her to use? It was, so in other words, in the profile, whatever the profile was, the discount rate right here of 6.72%, that is the internal rate of return. I gave her a discount rate to use that was above that. That means it's a negative NPV project. There is no question about it. There's no equivocation. Okay? It's just over. You had such a chance. I could have made you the captain of one of those battle cruisers. I mean, you would have looked so butch. Anyway. Okay. So you see the value of the net present of the internal rate of return in these calculations. It's like a fulcrum between the yes and the no. Here's something in the. I'm going to bring up a couple of things that I saw in consulting. I know that they're out there. There's a way the decision making is made in some companies, where they use something that's typically called a hurdle rate. A hurdle rate. Now, they just say, here is our hurdle rate for all projects. It's 8%. 8% is our hurdle rate for all projects. What they're saying, essentially, is that any project with an internal rate of return below that hurdle rate is a no. Any project with an internal rate of return above that hurdle rate is a yes. So what there is, this is surprisingly more popular than I would like it to be for a couple of reasons. It's not such a good idea. So they set a hurdle rate. That's the hurdle rate right there. So they're saying that any project with an internal rate of return below that is a no. Any project with an internal rate of return above that is a yes. So in other words, let's look at a couple of projects. Here's the NPV profile of project one. Here's the NPV profile of project two. So in other words, this hurdle rate see the internal rate of return for project one right there? It's below the hurdle rate, so they consider it negative net present value. See this project here, its internal rate of return is up here. So according to their modeling, that's a positive NPV project on the hurdle rate. It's essentially, there are two major problems with it. The first major problem with it is it's just a number that's pulled out of the air. I have actually asked, well, where did you get that hurdle rate? Well, we just always use that. You've always used this hurdle rate? When interest rates in the economy go up, interest rates in the economy go down, you just keep that hurdle rate for everything? Well, yeah. Is there a problem with that? Well, yeah, there's a problem with that. I mean, because, you know, the interest rate environment changes. The risks of projects change with the changing environment. But they hold on to this hurdle rate, and you can't tell them that's a bad idea. But, there you go. There's a deeper problem with that, and there's a deeper problem with the internal rate of return. And this is why I recommend that you use the internal rate of return very carefully if you're actually going to use it in the real world. The internal rate of return in all of finance, everything we do in finance, is subject to rock-hard laws of mathematics and even physics, interestingly enough. But rock-hard laws of mathematics are always behind the scenes in whatever we do. And I don't bring those up too often, those underlying mathematical principles. But here's one place where I do. The problem is with an NPV profile is that I draw it like that. That, what we call monotonic decreasing. In other words, the first derivative is negative always. That thing right there is the case only when there is only one switch in the sign of the cash flow. In other words, from negative to positive. That's what it looks like if there's one switch in cash flow. Negative initial, positive after that. Unfortunately, there are projects out there that start out, you put money in, then money comes back out, you make money, but then down the road you have to put more money in to start getting to keep the project fresh, technology, competition, something like that. If that is the case, the net present value profile looks like that. Or, depending on how many sign switches there are, the net present value, the internal rate of return, becomes what we call a spurious number. Depending upon where you would start searching for the internal rate of return, you could get two different answers. Now, if you did one with negative to positive to negative to positive cash flows on a calculator and said, where's the internal rate of return? It would give you a number. But what it would have done is it would have actually started its estimations on closer to one of the two roots of the graph than to the other root of the graph. Remember that polynomials, the roots of a quadratic and all that kind of, that's what this is. There are two roots, three roots. So the calculator would say, oh yeah, the internal rate of return is that, but that's because that's where it started estimating to find the internal rate of return, is closer to this one. If it had started up here somewhere, it probably would have found this one right here. That's the problem. It'll give you a bluff answer. What does that mean? It means, well, which one is right? Which one's the right internal rate of return? Actually, neither of them is right. There is no business explanation of the internal rate of return when there's more than one internal rate of return. There really isn't a way to explain it in terms of business. Well, we got two internal rates of return. What do those two internal rates of return mean? They don't mean anything because it's two internal rates of return. So you can't really talk about internal rate of return. It's just a completely mythical thing in that case. If there's only one cash flow switch, then it means everything. It's great. But if there's more than one cash flow switch, then it means nothing. Okay? Ouch. The thing, though, here is that anything that's based upon internal rate of return, hurdle rate, decision making, you always have to take it with kind of a grain of salt that, that might not be the best way to do this. Or if you're going to do it, you just make sure that you've got only one sign switch in your cash flows for the project. Show you something else here that's in the same line, though, is that most of the time in the real world, it's a mixed bag. You can take on as many projects as you want. As long as they're all positive net present value, you should be able to acquire the financing for all of them. That is the ideal. The reality is, well, probably you could have lots of great projects, but you probably aren't going to be able to afford to finance all of them. Because the more you go and ask for other people's money, the more they're going to charge you for it if it's debt. The lower your stock price is going to be if you keep trying to sell stock to raise capital for projects. So you're probably going to have a limited number of projects that you could ever take on to begin with. The decision-making rule is, okay, you lay out the projects, we'll figure out how much we can afford based upon an increasing marginal cost of capital. Like I said, the more you borrow, the harder the lenders are going to hit you with interest rates. The more you go to the stock markets, the less money you're going to pull on every offering of stock you do. So you're going to have this line of projects, and we're going to say, okay, only three or four of them. So how do you do that? Well, we got eight projects we looked at. Five were positive net present value. Okay. Well, you just take the highest three. Just take the highest three NPVs. Here's a weird thing. Okay, mutually exclusive projects. You could have two projects, they're both darn good projects, but you can't do them both. That would be the case if, for example, you had some limiting factor. Okay, we got this piece of land. Okay, we can use it either for this project or for this project. So we've got to decide which one of these projects we're going to use it for. We have this, we have some kind of a person, you, madam. You're a freaking genius. You are our guru of technology. He's over there. He lies. No. And you've got a couple of projects that you come up with. Well, I know darn well you can't do them both because you do have to sleep, not much, because basically you're a zombie. That's why you can do such great things. But the thing, though, is that I can't use you for two different projects. You are a limiting factor of production. A technology, I won't get into that, but there are technologies. You can't just use them as much as you want. There's a limit to how much you can burn on a certain technology. There's people in the cryptocurrency world, we call them hashers. They're kind of like bottom feeders, parasites in a way. Hashers use high-powered gaming computers, and all they do all day long is battle to find the solution to encryption of a Bitcoin. And if they are the first of the hashers to find the encryption, they get the coin. If they are not, they don't get the coin. So essentially, they are burning huge amounts of energy with these gaming machines that they use, high-speed access to the internet. But you see, there are other things they could do with these computers, but they can't because those computers are already roaring at top speed, hot as hell, drinking energy off the grid to find that, to be the first to find the solution for the encryption of the coin. And so there again, you've got multiple projects, but if you choose to hash, then you can't do the other things that you could be doing with that machine. Anyway, kind of looking at me like, what the hell is that? Yeah, that's sort of part of the crypto world, cryptocurrency world. But anyway, okay. So clearly, you've got mutually exclusive projects. Ah, obviously. Well, let's try something. Project one. Project two. NPV, IRR. Project one has an NPV of $3,200. Project two has an NPV of $4,000. Internal rate of return of project one is 14.25%. The internal rate of return of project two is 17.98%. Different decision. You choose NPV, project one. Choose internal rate of return, project two. You see it? It happens. It can happen. The book gives you one or two scenarios on how this can happen. It's a little weird. I've run into it in real life only once in my life did I see that the decision would be different, NPV versus IRR. Just once. And I honestly, to this day, I still don't quite understand why they were giving the contrary answers. Here's how you do it, NPV. You just go with the stronger, what we call the more robust method. NPV is more robust than IRR. So if there's a conflict, it would be like this. You are Arnold Schwarzenegger. You are Pee-wee Herman. Okay? Now, you say one way, you say the other way. Now, you've got some pretty good reasons. And you showed them to me in your fun house and all that kind of stuff. But you just stand there and, you know, I will be back. If I have to make a choice, I'm going to go with you. Sorry, but he's, you know, he's like, he's Arnold. Okay? So that's, I don't want to make it that simple. But honestly, if you've got a conflict like that, which should be really rare in real life, you just say NPV is the correct method. And also, if someone is using internal rate of return for mutually exclusive projects, you might want to back it up by looking at the NPVs to make sure the NPVs confirm the IRR choice. In other words, you're in a company where they don't do the NPVs, they just do IRRs. These are two mutually exclusive projects. You got to choose one or the other. And they say, oh, well, it's project two. Internal rate of return is higher. Step back and check with the NPVs to make sure that they confirm the choice with the internal rates of return. Because if they dispute the internal rates of return, throw the internal rate of return decision out and go with the NPV positive decision. This is only for mutually exclusive projects. Backing this up a little bit here, taking this back a step, there are some ways around the problem that multiple internal rates of return problem thing. And they fall under a general heading of modified internal rate of return, MIRR. MIRR. Let me show you one. I'm going to take a project here, year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. Now, this is a project where we are going to launch it with a cost of $25,000. We're going to push it out. Now, we know that this project is not done, and there are going to be defects, and this is a bad thing that companies really do. They'll push a project to product sales, knowing that there are going to be problems that they'll fix later. So in your first year, you get in the door $10,000. And the second year, the problem is that the cash flows begin to fall off. You go to $5,000. That's when you know, okay, people are catching on. This product isn't as good as we thought. So then you're going to throw in another, let's say, $8,000, and then do a strong PR campaign, pay people to swear your product is great now on Amazon and places like that. Pay off the bloggers and the magazine editors so that they love your product again. And so then your sales boost up. You got $15,000. Then you got $12,000. And then you're going to have to kick in one last boost just so you can get a few last sales out of it. Another, let's say, $5,000 out the door. And the last year, you get $10,000 in, and then you sell off the asset for $2,000, and then you close the project down and go do something else. You see your negative, positive, negative, positive? That means that there will be multiple internal rates of return. But you are absolutely dedicated to the internal rate of return. You came back as a zombie analyst, and now you work for the rebellion. The rebels have hired you, and you say, I still believe in internal rate of return. Okay. How do you do it? Well, there is a way. It's like a, sort of like a cluster of ways, and the book shows you one of the cluster. There are other tricks on this too. They're all sort of like variations on a theme. Here's one of the ways you do it. Okay, you take all of the negatives and you take those back as present values to the current period. And then you take all of the positives and you put those back out here to the future, and then to take that future value back to the present. Now you're looking, wait, what? Yeah, let me explain that again. You take all the negatives, you peel those off, zero them out in the year of occurrence because you pull those back to the their present values. And you put all those together and get a big negative present value. Okay? On the other hand, you take all the positives and you zero those out in their year of occurrence, and you pull those up here to the future value. I am so confused by what I'm doing here. Yeah. Okay. And then you put in your calculator a big negative on the cash flow of zero. Then you go zero, 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 zero. And then you got the big fat positive number out here on the end. You put that in, and then you say compute internal rate of return. Crickets. That's how you do it. It's stupid ass, but it actually gets you a single internal rate of return because you've got only one sign switch, negative and then positive. And it's called MIRR, modified internal rate of return. And like I said, there are several different variations on this I've seen over the years, and I vaguely recall being shown something that's a little bit different from this and called MIRR when I was in my PhD program. But the deal is this. Look, here's how you would do it. What I would want to do here, I just so don't want to do this. Let's take a discount rate of 7.5%. Now, I'm going to put together the negative 25,000, and then I'm going to put together plus negative 8,000 divided by 1 plus 0.075. to the what? 1, 2, 3 power plus negative 5,000 over 1 plus 0.075 to the what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 power. That will find me the present value of the negative component of the cash flow. Okay? And of course, no, I don't see anyone doing that on the calculator to help my sorry ass out. So, fine. Calculator. Seriously? Fine, I'll use my own calculator. Real calc. Okay. So, if I did... Oh, don't tell me I have to upgrade. No, I don't want to buy the 8,000 divided by 1. No, let's do it this way, clear. 8,000 times 1.075 to the negative third power plus 5,000 times 1.075 to the negative sixth power plus plus the 25,000 equals the total amount there comes out to be the present value of the negative components come out to be negative $34,679.49. That's the negative components of it. Then, you know what I'm wondering? It just occurred to me. Why would it matter? Why couldn't I just use that number right there and then just do the... Because they're all positive or zero from there on. That never occurred to me before. Do you see what I mean? I've gotten the negative piece out of it. I've gotten that out. So why wouldn't I just, instead of going through that pain in the ass of taking all these and getting the future value, why wouldn't I just now just treat this as a classic IRR problem? A negative cash flow at the beginning, and then positives, but a few zeros in there. Now, I know what the answer to this should be, and I'm going to try this. See if it works. Reset. Okay, now, cash flow. I'm going to do 34,000, what was that? 649.79 and 49 cents. Now, this is going to be an estimate because I'm not carrying a lot of decimal places here. Okay, now down. What's my first positive cash flow? 10,000. And that's 100,000. And that occurs once. And then what's the second year? Is it a zero?
5,000.
It is 5,000 in the second year. Okay, so 5,000. That occurs once. Year three.
Zero.
Okay. Year four.
15,000.
And that occurs once, right? And then what about five?
12,000.
12,000. And what about, enter? That's once. And what about the next one?
Zero.
Zero. Once. And what about the next one?
12,000.
12,000. Enter. That occurs once. Now, compute the internal rate of return. Damn it. Huh? For which ones? On what? On year one?
Yeah.
I was just testing you. You're absolutely right. Oh, my God. I went through all that work, and you wait until the end? Seriously? I won the race. Well, I saw you start that way. The race was going that way. The hell with it. You think for 1 minute my butt's going to do that one again? No. Okay, you see the point, though. Okay. Now, let me get to the big thing about what we're doing here. I want you to notice, taking all this stuff off the board and getting down to a deeper point about what we are doing in this subject. And by the way, I extended the deadlines for Chapter 8. This is Chapter 8. Until next week, if there's anything to clean up in the lecture, I'll do it on the first lecture of next week, but you have more time for that than I had originally given you. Here's the deal. At the end of the day, we are evaluating projects according to an actual meta-business model. Do you notice that in this way, net present values, internal rates of return, we are actually favoring projects that pay off sooner than projects that pay off later. Projects that have large cash flows in the early years are going to have more naturally, they are going to have more possibility of having a positive NPV than projects that are long, long haul, where the cash flows are steady but long term, or the payoffs happen years down the road. That's one of the unfortunate problems with this way that we decide anymore in the business world, is that we kind of pretend that this is the only way. This is the pinnacle of civilization and logic and all that. No, this way ensures that long-term projects or projects that actually have their greatest benefits years down the road, the greatest revenue streams years down the road, are not going to be accepted nearly as often as projects that have more immediate impact on our financial statements. And that is propelled by our thinking, how I teach you. It's propelled and flogged along by the boys on Wall Street. What the hell are you doing deciding on projects that are going to pay off 10 years down the road? We want our money now. That kind of mentality guarantees that we are not preparing intergenerationally. We're preparing for the here and now. Here's how some companies have been sort of battling this in their project decision-making framework. Some of the very largest companies on Earth, quite admittedly, they are in oligopolies. They do think and plan strategically. Not the vast majority of companies, which are in, for all intents and purposes, in monopolistic competition. If you remember that from your economics class. The companies that plan strategically generally are the oligopolies. They do not think about what's going to happen today or tomorrow or 5 years from now. They think about what is going to happen in 15, 50, 100 years. The one of the most loathsome individuals you would ever want to meet was the former chairman of Exxon. He looked like Jabba the Hutt. He just huge, splattering man, just a disgrace. But he was speaking after his retirement at this dinner for rich people. And he said, you know, these congressmen haul me up there. They haul us up there and they start talking to us about how we've got to wean ourselves off energy and all that, the fossil fuels. He said, they don't know anything. We're not stupid. We know that the oil will run out. We are planning for that. We're already out there. The same thing is true of a company like Intel. The chip that you see that they have just introduced is one of perhaps only five that are in one stage or another of research and development. Those chips that they are planning, they would blow you away what they'll be able to do in 10, 15, 30 years. Companies planning for mining operations on asteroids way out there, yeah, but it requires a company that is so huge that it can live for the future and starve in the present. That's what this is all about, is that the downside is that these huge companies drain our resources. They are bad, bad citizens in the here and now, but they do plan for the future, unlike most companies that would reject a project because it has a negative NPV because its cash flows are way out there. So it's a balancing act that we have to face. And that's all I have for you. Go home.